The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Demi Arsenault for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Winter 2025 issue of Discover Magazine. We'll start with a column from our Origins section titled Battle Bitten. A skeleton covered in bite marks confirms that gladiators fought animals even in the farthest reaches of the Roman Empire. The tales of Roman gladiators going head-to-head with lions are legendary. But is there any truth to these stories? A bite-ridden skeleton from around 1,800 years ago suggests that there is. Analyzed in April 2025 study in PLOS-1, the bones represent the first forensic proof that gladiators actually fought animals in the arenas of ancient Rome. For years, our understanding of Roman gladiatorial combat and animal spectacles has relied heavily on historical texts and artistic depictions, says Tim Thompson, a study author and an anthropologist at Maynooth University, in a statement released with the research. This discovery provides the first direct physical evidence that such events took place in this period, reshaping our perception of Roman entertainment and culture. Remarkably, the skeleton came not from Italy, but rather from a Roman cemetery in York, England. Since excavation started there in 2024, archaeologists have examined the remains of 82 young men, all of which showed signs of intense physical activity and injury. But the skeleton of one man stood out, featuring a set of indentations in the pelvis that looked a lot like bite marks. Comparing the indentations to tooth impressions of cheetahs, leopards, lions, and tigers, the authors of the new study confirmed that the injury, which was sustained around the time of the man's death, came from combat with a large cat. The bite marks were likely made by a lion, says Malin Holst, another study author and archaeologist from the University of York, which confirms that the skeletons buried at the cemetery were gladiators rather than soldiers or slaves as initially thought. The skeleton's location suggests that the battles between the gladiators and animals were widespread, occurring well beyond the Colosseum and the core of the Roman Empire. These latest findings show that these sporting events had a far reach, Holst said. An amphitheater probably existed in Roman York, but this has not yet been discovered. And this from Paul Smeglick. And next, for our dinosaur lovers out there, the Dragon Prince Dinosaur. A new species represents the closest relative to the large tyrannosaurs, including Tyrannosaurus rex. The king of the dinosaurs has finally found its prince. In June of 2025, a study in Nature described the discovery of a new species, Cancalunu mongoliensis, which fills in the family tree of one of the world's most famous dinosaurs. We identified a new species of tyrannosaurid, an ancestor to the apex predatory tyrannosaurs, says Jared Voris, a study author and PhD student at the University of Calgary, in a statement. Basically, right before they got to be these apex predators, tyrannosaurs were these medium-sized, fleet-footed predators that lived in the shadows of other apex predators. The name Cancalunu comes from the Mongolian for the dragon prince and was chosen because the new species is the last step in the lineage before the appearance of the larger tyrannosaurs, including the king of the Cretaceous, Tyrannosaurus rex. We wanted something to epitomize how it's not quite the king yet, Voris said. We wanted something that comes before a king, which is a prince. Cancalunu roamed the Cretaceous Earth around 86 million years ago, or about 20 million years before T-Rex. Although it did share many characteristics with the later tyrannosaurs, it was quite a bit smaller, around 2 to 3 times smaller, at about 13 feet long and 1,650 pounds. The new species had small horns that it would not have been as intimidating or as impressive in mating as those on later tyrannosaurs like Albertosaurus or Gorgosaurus. It also lacked the jaw strength of T-Rex, since its head was long and shallow. While Kankulu may have not had the sheer brute force of the larger tyrannosaurs, that doesn't mean it went hungry. Characterized as a mesopredator, a medium-sized carnivore, Kankulu was actually quite similar to the modern coyote in its hunting practices, its speed and agility making up for what it lacked in power. Surprisingly, the fossils of Kankulu are not a new find. Paleontologist Altangarel Pearl originally discovered them in Mongolia during the 1970s. The theory up until now was that these fossils belonged to Electrosaurus, another medium-sized tyrannosaur from China. As part of his PhD studies, Voris traveled to analyze fossils at Mongolia's Institute of Paleontology. While examining the Kankulu species, he noticed many features that differentiated them from the Electrosaurus and determined that they were likely from a different species altogether. Finding a new species is always very exciting, and Darla Zelenitsky, another study author and an associate professor at the University of Calgary. It tells us how tyrannosaurs as a group became so diverse and successful at the end of the Cretaceous. Most importantly, Kankulu represents the long-lost link between the small and large tyrannosaurs. We've never really had a good representation of that transition, Voris said. This new species actually provides us that window into the ascent of the stage of the tyrannosaurs. The species also offers important insights into the movement of the tyrannosaurs, which migrated from Asia to North America at around the same time that they transformed into apex predators. In fact, Kankulu was likely the species that made the long trek over the land bridge from Asia to North America, where one tyrannosaur lineage would eventually evolve into T-Rex. Kankulu, or a closely related species, would have immigrated to North America from Asia around 85 million years ago, Zelenitsky said. Our study provides solid evidence that large tyrannosaurs first evolved in North America, and as a result of this immigration event. While Kankulu is no longer in the shadows, the researchers stress that there are other early tyrannosaurs just waiting to be discovered. Their hope is to find fossils from these dinosaurs to learn more about them and their larger descendants. And that from Stephanie Edwards. And while we're talking about dinosaurs, we're going to keep going with a proven plant eater. Plants from a sauropod's gut provide the first fossilized proof that the dinosaurs were herbivores. The sauropods, the largest and tallest of the dinosaurs, are almost always described as vegetarians. In June of 2025, paleontologists finally confirmed this, publishing a paper on the first confirmed gut contents from a sauropod in Current Biology, suggesting that the dinosaurs ate plants, and lots of them. No genuine sauropod gut contents have ever been found anywhere before, despite sauropods being known from fossils found on every continent, said Stephen Poropat, a paper author and paleontologist at Curtin University, in a statement. This finding confirms several hypotheses about the sauropod diet that has been made based on studies of their anatomy. The gut contents were found in Australia in 2017 when researchers spotted a clump of fossilized material within the abdomen of a subadult Diamantinosaurus matildae sauropod, a species that lived around 100 million years ago. After analyzing the clump, called a coalolite, the team concluded that the animal ate an abundance of plants, including non-flowering and flowering flora, from conifer foliage to seed fern fruiting bodies to shoots and seed pods. The plants within show evidence of having been severed, possibly bitten, but have not been chewed, Poropat said. This implies that at least some sauropods were not selective feeders, instead eating whatever plants they could reach and safely process. Although it wasn't shocking that the sauropod was a plant eater, the flowering plants within its gut were a surprise, showing that the animal had adapted to these species, adding them to its diet within 40 million years of the plant's appearance in the fossil record. The study suggests that the success of sauropods, which roamed the Earth for more than 130 million years, may have been thanks to their indiscriminate diet. Still, there's only so much that a single dinosaur can tell us. The sauropod gut contents we describe constitute a single data point, Poropat said. These gut contents only tell us about the last meal or several meals of a single subadult sauropod. Authored by Monica Cull. Our next article is Dennis Sovin's Find a Face. Ancient proteins and DNA confirm that a 146,000-year-old hominin skull belonged to a Denisovan. A molar, a mandible, a partial pinky finger. These are the types of fragmentary remains that have represented the Denisovans since their discovery in 2010. But in June of 2025, researchers introduced a much more distinctive Denisovan fossil, revealing the face of these ancient humans for the first time. Reporting these results in parallel studies in Science and Cell, the researchers identified an almost complete hominin skull as belonging to a Denisovan. The specimens were discovered at Harbin, China, and it dates back to around 146,000 years ago. Analyzing its proteins and its DNA, the team confirmed that the skull shares molecular traits with other Denisovan specimens from across Asia, providing important insights into the appearance and distribution of these ancient humans. Denisovans are a hominin group primarily known through the genomes or proteins, but their precise morphological features remain elusive, the researchers wrote in Science. This study fills the gap between the morphological and molecular evidence, enhancing our understanding of Denisovans. Initially described in 2021, the Harbin skull is low and long from a lateral perspective, with a pronounced brow bone. Based on these traits, the specimen was designated as its own species, dubbed Homo longi, or dragon man. But since that initial description, some scientists have wondered whether the skull also represented the Denisovans, who, along with the Neanderthals, are our closest human relatives. To learn more about the skull and to determine whether it came from these ancient humans, the researchers behind the 2025 studies developed two distinct approaches. First, they retrieve proteins from the skull and match them to proteins from other hominins. Second, they recovered DNA from the skull's dental calculus, or calcified dental plaque, and compared it to DNA from modern humans, Neanderthals, and Denisovans. The first method demonstrated that the proteome, or the complete set of proteins within the skull, contained 122 amino acid variants that are unique to hominids, and three that are unique to Denisovans, having been found in the first Denisovan fossils recovered from Siberia's Denisova cave. This match established a strong evolutionary link between the skull and this ancient human lineage. Meanwhile, the second method allowed the researchers to build libraries of Denisovan DNA from the skull, including several group-specific genetic mutations, which confirmed what protein analysis had already revealed, that the Harbin skull clearly belongs to these hominins. The confirmation that this skull came from a Denisovan gives researchers a stronger sense of what these ancient humans looked like. It also suggests that these hominins occupied much of Asia in the Middle Pleistocene, spanning from Siberia to China and beyond between around 300,000 and 78,000 years ago. The team hopes that these results will fuel further research into Denisovan proteins and DNA, while also providing new methods for identifying more fossils from this lineage in the future, both on the basis of their ancient molecules and their morphology. The finding, the researchers concluded in Cell, connects Denisovans with morphological traits and will help identify other specimens as Denisovans, especially when ancient DNA is not preserved or is difficult to obtain. Authored by Stephanie Edwards. Next, we have CRISPR Gets Personal. The first personalized gene editing therapy opens the door to new treatments for rare genetic disorders. When CRISPR was first introduced as a gene editing tool in 2012, the world was in awe of all the possibilities it held, eventually earning its discoverers the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2020. Now, after years of refining the technology and running clinical trials, gene editing has taken a major leap toward personalized medicine. In 2025, researchers from Penn Medicine and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also known as CHOP, successfully treated a baby boy with a rare metabolic disorder using personalized CRISPR therapy. Their case study, published in May in the New England Journal of Medicine, demonstrates the powerful potential of precision gene editing for rare diseases. As Kiran Musunuru, professor of translational research at Penn Medicine, put it in a news release, the promise of gene therapy that we've heard about for decades is coming to fruition, and it's going to utterly transform the way we approach medicine. Ironically, a rare genetic disease aren't as uncommon as they sound. In the U.S., about 1 in 10 people live with a rare disorder. What makes them rare is that each individual condition typically affects fewer than 2,000 people, making research and treatment development incredibly challenging. One of those affected is KJ. He was born in 2024 with CPS1 deficiency, a urea cycle disorder caused by the absence of a key enzyme the body needs to eliminate ammonia, a toxic byproduct of protein metabolism. Since liver transplants aren't viable until patients are older, this condition carries a 50% mortality rate in early infancy. Fortunately, Musunuru and Rebecca Ahrens-Nicholas, director of CHOP's Gene Therapy for Inherited Metabolic Disorders Frontier Program, also known as GTIMD, had been studying this class of disorders for years and reached out to KJ's family shortly after his diagnosis. "We thought it was our responsibility to help our child, so when the doctors came to us with their idea, we put our trust in them in the hopes that it could help not just KJ, but other families in our position," said his mother, Nicole Muldoon. In just 6 months, the researchers developed a personalized treatment. In February 2025, KJ received his first infusion, a dose of CRISPR components delivered to his liver using lipid nanoparticles. CRISPR, which is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, acts like a smart pair of molecular scissors. In KJ's case, it was custom designed to find the faulty gene and fix the error, snipping out the flawed segment of his DNA. After receiving multiple doses, KJ has shown significant improvement. He's now able to eat more protein and recover from everyday childhood illnesses without the dangerous ammonia buildup that once threatened his life. Even better, he's had no serious side effects from the treatment. While KJ will need to be monitored carefully for the rest of his life, our initial findings are quite promising, added Ahrens-Nicholas. For KJ and his family, this breakthrough has brought a seemingly endless hospital stay to an end. "We are excited to be able to finally be home together so that KJ can be with his siblings and we can finally take a deep breath," said his father, Kyle Muldoon. For others, the case offers a hopeful path forward, one where gene editing may now fulfill its bright promise to save patients with no other treatment options. Years and years of progress in gene editing and collaboration between researchers and clinicians have made this moment possible. And while KJ is just one patient, we hope he is the first of many to benefit from a methodology that can be scaled to fit an individual patient's need, Ahrens-Nicholas said. From Jenny Lehman. Our next article is Hacking Mood Disorders with Ultrasound. Ultrasound treatments are on the rise, and they're not just for imaging anymore. Ultrasound, or sound that's above the audible spectrum, has long been used to visualize the internal structures in the body. But recently, researchers have been pushing the boundaries of what this safe, non-invasive method can do, implementing it to treat medical conditions. Today, ultrasound helps destroy tumors, alleviate chronic pain, support drug delivery, and even slow neurodegenerative disease. In 2025, researchers from Dell Medical School at the University of Texas at Austin explored whether this technology could also be used to treat mood, anxiety, and trauma-related disorders, also known as MATRDs. The results published in Molecular Psychiatry in April are promising. Participants with depression and other mood disorders reported significant relief from their symptoms after receiving targeted ultrasound to specific brain regions. Major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, and PTSD continue to affect millions. Traditional treatments like medication and psychotherapy can be helpful, but they don't work for everyone. Many patients experience side effects, incomplete relief, or simply don't respond at all. To expand the treatment options that are available to these patients, researchers have looked into the amygdala, a brain region that becomes notably hyperactive in those with mood and anxiety disorders. While antidepressants, benzodiazepines, and talk therapy may influence amygdala activity, the Dell Med team wondered if an ultrasound could offer a more direct approach. Using MRI guidance, the researchers applied low-intensity focused ultrasound, or LIFU, to the left amygdala, an area that plays a major role in emotionally charged thinking and memory. In the first part of the study, they found that ultrasound could successfully reduce activity in this region by altering blood oxygen levels, which is a key marker of brain activity. In the second part, the researchers tested the effects of daily ultrasound sessions over the course of 3 weeks. The results? A noticeable drop in amygdala activity over time, and more importantly, improvements in mood. Participants show marked improvements across a range of symptoms after just 3 weeks of daily treatments, said Gregory Fonzo, a study author and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Dell Med, in a press statement. What makes this approach revolutionary is that it's the first time we've been able to directly modulate deep brain activity without invasive procedures or medications. Participants in the study tolerated the ultrasound treatment, experiencing no side effects. The encouraging results have laid the groundwork for the next phase of testing, double-blind, randomized clinical trials, the gold standard for proving treatment efficacy. For decades, the amygdala has been a target of interest, but access has either required brain surgery or indirect approaches through cortical stimulation, Fonzo said. This technology opens a new frontier in psychiatric treatment, potentially offering relief to patients who haven't responded to traditional therapies. As ultrasound continues to expand beyond diagnostics, it's emerging as a flexible, personalized tool that could transform the way we approach mental health, offering hope for those still searching for relief. And that authored by Jenny Lehman. One additional piece goes with that article, titled Ultrasound for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Nature made clear how precious our brains are by protecting them with a combination of skin, bone, and cerebral fluid, presenting a challenge for any medical intervention in the brain. But this is where non-invasive technologies like ultrasound come in. Its auditory approach has the potential to access specific brain areas with precision without the intrusion of a single scientific instrument. Take the use of ultrasound for treating Parkinson's, for instance. Since 2018, Parkinson's patients have been able to receive LIFU to address motor symptoms like tremors, spasms, stiffness, and slowness. Since LIFU delivers symptomatic relief by making thermal lesions deep in the brain non-invasively, it provides a safer and cheaper alternative to established surgery procedures. Meanwhile, ultrasound has already shown success in treating Alzheimer's in clinical trials and will hopefully move toward FDA approval soon. For these patients, focused ultrasound can open the blood-brain barrier, the highly protected gateway to the brain, to either allow the removal of accumulating beta amyloid and tau proteins, which cause neuronal damage, or to help potent drugs enter the brain more easily. And last but not least, a related article, Surprising Signs of Early Alzheimer's. Mood disorders later in life could indicate brain changes tied to dementia. Memory problems are typically one of the first signs of Alzheimer's disease. So, too, are struggles with communication and everyday problem solving. But scientists are now uncovering evidence of another early signal, mood disorders like depression and bipolar disorder, which begin later in life. While a link between Alzheimer's and these disorders has long been suspected, what's missing is a clear understanding of how the two connect in the brain. But that's starting to change. Researchers from Japan's National Institutes for Quantum Science and Technology, or QST, found significant amounts of tau protein, which is a hallmark of Alzheimer's, in the brains of people with late-life mood disorders, or LLMDs. Their study, published in Alzheimer's and Dementia in June 2025, suggests that these psychiatric disorders may serve as a warning sign for neurodegenerative disease. To investigate if mood changes could be among the earlier signs of Alzheimer's, the QST team used brain imaging to examine 52 people diagnosed with LLMDs and 47 healthy controls. The study found tau accumulation in the brains of about 50% of LLMD patients, while only 15% of healthy participants showed these same patterns. Additionally, close to 29% of the mood disorder group also had amyloid deposits, another feature of Alzheimer's, while only 2% of the control group did. To back up these results, the researchers analyzed 208 autopsy cases and found the same trend. Individuals who had experienced late-life depression or mania were significantly more likely to have tau-related pathologies. Based on the autopsy data, mood changes tended to precede memory or motor problems by an average of 7.3 years. The implications could be profound, suggesting that some cases of late-life depression or bipolar disorder might actually be the earliest phase of a neurodegenerative disease. If doctors identify these mood disorders sooner, it could open the door to earlier detection and treatment of Alzheimer's, when such treatments can still make a difference. And that from Jenny Lehman. And I won't have time for this full article, but I did want to read this interesting bit on baby memories. Researchers suggest that we do make memories as babies, despite not remembering them as adults. There's a lot that your parents probably remember from your time as a baby, but you've forgotten all of it, a phenomenon called infantile amnesia. A March 2025 study demonstrates that babies do encode memories in the first years of their lives, and linking babies' brain activity during memory encoding to measures of memory recall in infants for the first time. It's a very interesting article if you're able to get your hands on Discover Magazine to read the whole thing. And unfortunately, now we've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Demi Arsenault for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-852-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.